Thank you very
You're
much.
Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Good morning, everybody. Today, I'll be presenting some preliminary findings from our qualitative research study called the MASAI Project. MASAI stands for Men Acting with Strength and Initiative. The study looks at the social context of HIV among a sample of 60 bisexually active African-American men in the San Francisco Bay Area. And before I begin, I'd just like to acknowledge my study team, Dr. Cynthia Gomez as co-investigator, project coordinator, crew, Saifa Wall in the house, and Deborah Allen and Bill Stewart, who were recruiters and interviewers. Okay, nothing to disclose. Okay, so just briefly, I'll give a little background on the topic of bisexually active African-American men and HIV, and also the origins of our study. I really want to sort of scoot through some of the background to really get into the preliminary qualitative findings in dialogue with what's being discussed on the panel today. And then we'll talk about some implications. Okay. From the beginning of the epidemic, African Americans have accounted for a disproportionate share of HIV/AIDS cases, as I'm sure you all know. This chart shows two cross-sectional snapshots in time of AIDS in the United States. It shows the percentage of total AIDS cases among African Americans and whites in 1983, and then most recently in 2008. So the two columns on the left refer are cases among African Americans, and on the right are non-Hispanic whites. So we can see that fully 25% of AIDS cases in 1983 were among African Americans, twice their population percentage. This has increased to a burden of almost half of all AIDS cases in 2008. At the same time, the burden of disease has decreased by almost 50% among whites, from 58% of AIDS cases in 83 to 28% in 2008. New HIV infections in the United States in 2006. Here we see the high numbers of new HIV infections among black MSM, which is the second column to the left, as well as among black heterosexual women and also black heterosexual men. These statistics translate into the fact that 1 in 16 black men will be diagnosed with HIV at some point in his lifetime, as will 1 in 30 black women. Among black men, the odds of having HIV are 30 times greater for men who have sex both with men and women than for men who have sex just with women, which is about twice the odds of having HIV for MSM, which is 13 times that of men who have sex with women. Okay. So here we see, instead of just numbers, we see rates. So the figure shows disproportionate rates of new HIV infections. And I think we can just see the vast disparities here. I think the figures speak for themselves. In the San Francisco Bay Area, where our study was conducted, in San Francisco, about a third of African-American men who have sex with men are estimated to be HIV positive. And African-Americans make up 44% of AIDS cases in Alameda County, while representing 17% of the population. So I'm framing this in this way because I believe that it is important to understand the disproportionate burden of HIV among African-American men and women, because these statistics taken together have informed how bisexually active African-American men have been represented by popular media, think Oprah, J.L. King, and the construction of the Down Low, as discussed by David, as well as by public health and HIV prevention campaigns. This HIV prevention campaign in South Central LA states, on the down low, when a man risks HIV infection, he risks infecting his wife and their baby. This poster is a glimpse into how HIV disparities among both men and women have been interpreted in a victim vector narrative, which does several things. It is based on many as yet unknowns about transmission among bisexually active men. It plays into and reinforces dominant notions and understandings of gender. It perpetuates historical and persistent racist understandings of black male sexuality. And in so doing, it reinforces individual behaviorist frameworks for understanding HIV and takes critical attention away from the social and structural context of HIV transmission among bisexually active men and their female and male partners. Bisexually active men constitute a convenient scapegoat through frameworks that play into and reinforce social discrimination as experienced by and also within African-American communities. Okay. So I feel like David has covered most of this background, so I'm actually just going to zip through. If we have questions on this, we can come back to it. What I do want to point out is that research really has pointed to the fact that high rates of HIV among bisexually active men are driven primarily by low SES, drug sex economy, injection drug use, higher numbers of sex partners, and lower rates of condom use. So the Maasai study emerged from a formative research project with heterosexually identified black men and women in the Bay Area, in which we heard from quite a few men a lot of anger at what it was back in 2006 when the movie Brokeback Mountain, thank you, when Brokeback Mountain came out. And a lot of men in our sample referenced this movie as an example of racism in understandings of sexuality, with the images of what they were calling down low brothers. These are two white men on the down low. This was a beautiful narrative. It elicited sympathy. People were, you know, busting out the Kleenex. This would never be possible if this were two black men on the screen. Okay, so this was a very powerful moment in time. And a lot of these men had a lot to say and a lot of anger about the down low, in particular with regard to their own lives and the fact that they were having sex with men, as quote on the side. So we set out to follow up on this and do some work. Here the study aims to really try to build theoretical understandings, looking at the structural cultural conditions of this so-called down low, in quotes, really looking at in-depth narratives and hearing people's voices, really building on the work of Dr. Dodge and Mel Brunch here. The second specific aim focuses primarily on incarceration, and I won't get so much into that data today. Okay. We've completed 59 qualitative interviews. We're in the process of wrapping up our data collection. Two-thirds of the sample are HIV negative, one-third positive. I wanted to have just behavioral eligibility criteria, the eligibility was African-American males over 18 who'd had sex with a woman and a man in the past year. However, after a few weeks of recruitment in San Francisco, we were generating a lot of gay guys who were having sex with men. I mean, with women, excuse me. So we added an exclusion criteria, self-identification as gay. And recruitment was a whole other talk that was yesterday, so I'm going to leave that to yesterday. But I'm happy to talk about recruitment. Lots of things came up around that. So we did qualitative interviews, 1 to 2 or 2+ hours. People talked. They talked a lot. We asked questions about childhood, growing up, coming to understandings of their sexuality, sexual identity, masculinity, HIV, sexual risk, disclosure, and incarceration. We've completed data analysis with a third of the transcripts, a third of the data. So the findings today are based on analysis of 20 interviews. We had a quantitative SES measure in there and also did some ethnographic mapping and field notes. Okay, so just briefly, we had kind of a relatively educated but low income and underemployed, at least in the formal sector, sample. Okay, so we see that 80% of our sample were not working currently, again, formally. Education, about a third had a high school diploma, about a third some college. Oh, I didn't change that color. About 20% had a four-year degree. We had one guy with multiple degrees from Stanford and Duke. I guess the $40 was enough for him. And low income, low income. Two-thirds under $10,000 a year. Sexual identity, and this was asked in an open-ended manner in the interview. We didn't have people check out boxes. We asked people how they identified themselves. And we sometimes this generated pages and pages of transcript data around how they identified. This is very complex matters here. So about a quarter did not identify, about 20% were heterosexual. Within the bisexual category here, about half, some actually did have kind of an integrated or harnessed sense of a bisexual identity, and about half of the folks who discussed bisexuality did not. And it was sort of an aha moment. I guess you could call me descriptively bisexual because I'm having sex with men and women. Okay, so really getting into the findings here. Preliminary findings from our analysis to date. indicate that bisexually active African-American men deploy specific sexual identities and behaviors in the context of experiences of homophobia, racism, and notions of masculinity and gender norms that condition the possibilities of their sexual lives. So in the interest of time, I'll just present data just on a few of the main findings, looking at the particular workings of masculinities throughout. Masculinities came up pretty much embedded in everything throughout these interviews. Masculinity, or understandings of what it is to be a man, underscored so much of their descriptions of sexual development, sexual awareness, sexual practices, sexual identities or non-identification. Participants described the importance of family context, oftentimes fathers, brothers, sisters, aunts, grandparents, and the church in particular as forming their sense of how to be a man as they were growing up. And men described an ongoing negotiation of vulnerability in terms of kind of social and structural factors, and also strategies for building masculinity, and particularly behaviorally. Being a man was defined by many in this sample as not being gay. This participant defines manhood in contradistinction to being gay, wondering if he is a man or if he is gay. He identifies as heterosexual and has had sex with men since he was young. Then he says, "From time to time, I question myself about it, you know, whether I was a man or I was gay, or and my reality, my religious background, and the male role models that has been in my life, and it's not morally acceptable. Having a gay desire for another male, it's not socially acceptable." This guy was very, very covert, let's say. He was absolutely not open at all with anybody, and he kind of commented on this, that the interviewer was the first person he'd ever talked to about this. Talked a lot about social acceptability. It no longer really matters what society has to say, but it does matter. It doesn't matter as strong as it did before, because images have been put in front of society about what is described as acceptable male, female, or human behavior. Homophobia and biphobia, again in relationship to masculinity and gender roles and norms. Many participants described the long-standing influence of growing up in the church with often devastating effects on their mental health in particular. At the same time, men also described kind of silent understandings in the church. We heard from a current preacher and many men who had been involved closely in the church throughout their lives of the ways in which sex with men is just embedded there, but people just don't talk about it. It's just there, it's the way it is. On the individual level, men described being socialized often by family members, family of origin, and also female partners. They talked a lot about the homophobia on the part of their female partners. And we'll get into that in a minute in terms of the data. Internalized homophobia, really, really deep and intense experiences of internalized homophobia. Many of the participants attributed their very existence to having access to some form of social service. Also, as they described their lives, men described a profound sense of exclusion from any community or identity based on sexuality, and indeed, they did not necessarily desire to be included within. Interestingly, what men described wanting, oftentimes at the end, the interviewers would ask what vision they had for their lives. And time and again, interestingly, men described wanting to be in committed relationships. It's interesting, this kind of bias toward relationships that you bring up. I think here, you know, guys would say, well, what I want to do, and most of them were not in committed relationships, but they had a fantasy. And they were sort of reinscribing and reinstating this white picket fence fantasy. They wanted to have two partners, they wanted a male and female partner. Our guys were primarily over 45, they wanted children. Literally, white picket fences came up. It was very, very interesting kind of fantasy. And often very painfully described. They would kind of realize, I don't think this is going to happen. This participant describes a wrenching story of the effects of his disclosure to his girlfriend of his long-term relationship with a guy that he has just left. So they had run into his former partner, this guy at the gym, and he finally told her. She pushed him. They were exchanging a piece of clothing or something intimate was happening, and she cottoned on. And he said, she told me she was going to have the abortion. She ends up having an abortion. Not so much because she was mad or hurt, but because she didn't ever want me to leave her for a man. and that she would not want her baby to know that his daddy was sick and disgusting and perverted, because that's what she thought of bisexuality or homosexuality. She thought it was sick, nasty, disgusting, perverted, and gross. And in some ways, I agree with that, because religiously, that's what I was taught. We planned the baby, and we made it. We even chose a name for him. So the fact that she did that was, if there was so much investment in who he was going to be, I was just sick after that. It's a very hard thing for me to read. Okay. I know time is of essence. Just sort of descriptively what we heard around sexual, quote, risk in terms of HIV. Unprotected sex came up primarily in the context of substance use in the drug sex economy. Alcohol came up. Guys referred to alcohol as courage juice, getting up the courage to hook up with guys. And crack. One guy referred to crack as instigating a heterosexual sex revolution among heterosexual men, driving sex with men. We heard more instances of unprotected sex with female partners, and also the few guys who did have primary partners. Disclosure, we did hear, was more frequent with male partners. We also heard and got senses, obviously from the male perspective, that the women in their lives did have some form of knowledge, possibly, about what was happening in terms of other relationships, which raises the question, what do women know, to me? Many, if not all participants, talked about navigating forms of street prevention. Am I out of time? Okay. So lots of forms of sexual risk reduction strategies were being employed. These guys, in particular, the HIV-positive men, were very reflective and practicing a lot of forms of sexual risk reduction. Here's a quote about this. We can come back to that. Incarceration, I think I'll skip over. This quote is related to masculinity. In prison, you're not a man. I'm always going to be a man. And he gets into how he's just completely demasculinized through his experience in prison. The DL. Okay, so areas for further exploration. Looking into further the cultural understandings of, gender among men and women. The need to develop intersectional theoretical frameworks for prevention at the structural, cultural, and individual levels. And I'm very interested in conducting further investigation with both female and males and female partners of bisexually active men. Thank you. Sorry for my time.
Thank you very much.